It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Wisconsin Assembly passed a bill earlier this month that would end the moratorium on new nuclear power plants in Wisconsin. We'll get two perspectives on that issue.
First, the Iowa caucuses are 5 days away, and it remains a tight race between Cruz and Trump and Sanders and Clinton. Last night brought a dramatic twist to the Republican side, with Donald Trump saying that he's not going to attend the final debate before the caucus because of a feud with the host Megyn Kelly and the Fox Network in general. He's holding his own event instead.
On the Democratic side, the race has tightened in Iowa between Clinton and Sanders. Time now for our weekly look at the latest in national politics with senior political writer and analyst for 538, Harry Enten. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, before we get to these snowball fights in Iowa, I understand you had a bit of snow in your neck of the woods, Harry. How hard were you hit?
Well, New York City, Central Park recorded 26.8 inches of snow. JFK Airport, a little over 30 inches of snow. New York City never shuts down, but they closed the roads down on Saturday night, but they did reopen them on Sunday. It was the second largest storm ever to hit Central Park in recorded history.
And sometimes here in Wisconsin, when they report on big snowfall elsewhere in the country, we say, oh, that's no big deal. That's a lot of snow wherever you are. So, and you wrote a piece about what this tells us about predicting snowfall, and you've been watching that sort of statistical stuff. What do we learn? Are we doing a good job?
Well, yes and no. The models, most of the models in New York City, we were right at the northern edge of the snow, and the models suggested, most of them, that the heaviest snow would stay just to the south of New York. But one model, in fact, suggested that New York City would get into the heavy snow. And, you know, kind of putting that into a political context in some sort of way or comparing it to politics, I think it shows how important it is that we talk in probabilities, not saying this won't happen, but rather saying there's a low chance of something happening. And I think that that's a lesson that consistently we learn from weather, is that you never quite know when you're going to have that black swan event, when something truly unique is about to take place.
And we're going to go from the snowstorm to a political storm, a bit of one anyway, with Donald Trump saying, against all odds, it seems unlikely, but he's saying he's going to sit out the debate tomorrow night, partly because of Megyn Kelly, partly because of Fox News in general. What do you make of that? What's going on there?
You know, I have long since gotten past the point of trying to figure Donald Trump out. I've also gotten long since the point of doubting Donald Trump. Every single time one of us in the media doubts Donald Trump, he manages to go up in the polls. But if I were Trump, I think what's really going on here is I think he recognizes that he's risen in the polls the past couple of weeks. The majority of the polls coming out of Iowa right now show him with a small lead. So why should he enter a debate in which he'll get attacked from all sides and potentially lose support in Iowa when he can try and freeze the race exactly where it is? Obviously, the downside is, if he's not there, maybe people think, oh, he's a crybaby. He doesn't want to have to take on Megyn Kelly. But clearly he's making the bet that most people will not care about that. Rather, they'll just recognize that he didn't make any mistakes on the debate stage.
Well, he won't be there on the debate stage. Will the other candidates be free to take pot shots at him? Could that backfire on them if he's not there to defend himself? We're in uncharted territory here.
It's exactly right. You know, I fully expect the other candidates will take shots at him. But there's a question of how many people actually tune in, because there's a belief out there that a good percentage of the increase that we've seen in the debate audience on the Republican side is because Donald Trump is there. And Trump is basically saying, you know what, if I'm not there, no one's going to be watching anyway. So what's the big deal?
Do you think this feud is genuine? Does this genuinely arise from feelings of, you know, being mistreated by Fox News? Or is there a sense that this is manufactured at all?
I think that there's a little bit of both. I mean, Trump is supposedly going on Bill O'Reilly tonight. So, you know, I don't know how much of it is truly against Fox News, how much of it is truly against Megyn Kelly. How much of it is just Trump having an ego and saying, if I can't have things my way, then you're not going to get anything at all. Trump is a fascinating figure, both politically and non-politically, and trying exactly to understand what's going through his mind is something that is well above my pay grade.
Well, let's look at historical data here. What's happened in the past when leading primary candidates have dropped out of Iowa debates over a Twitter feud 1 week before the primary? Oh, no, wait. We don't have any precedent to work with here, do we?
You know, the only thing I really can sort of think about that may be somewhat similar to this is in 1980, not even in a, well, there was a primary thing with Reagan, but the one I'm specifically thinking of is when incumbent President Jimmy Carter refused to debate Ronald Reagan and John Anderson in September of that year because he didn't want to debate with Anderson being on the stage as well. And that really didn't help Carter very much. I'm not sure how much it hurt him as much as a bad debate performance in late October did. But I would say not being there is not as bad as being there and doing poorly.
We're talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Does it seem at all strange that this is the choice that he's made, Donald Trump, on the eve, more or less, of the Iowa caucus? Doesn't he want to be out there? Is this going to influence anything that happens on Monday?
You know, yes and no. He's going to be holding his own event separately. I wouldn't be shocked if either CNN and or MSNBC cover that event while Fox has the debate going. But again, even though he's not on the debate stage, all we're talking about is Donald Trump. Donald Trump has managed to command so much media attention, so much more than any of the other candidates, even though his net favorability rating in the state of Iowa among Republicans is lower than Ted Cruz's, is lower than Marco Rubio's, is lower than Ben Carson's, yet he has been able to have all of this media attention. And I think it's just a genius play if he wants to keep the media on him. I'm not showing up at the debate. He's gotten more media from that than he probably otherwise would have.
I want to throw this out to our listeners, by the way, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision, the front runner, Donald Trump, on the Republican side, not going to the last debate before the Iowa caucus? Call in with your reaction, 800-642-1234. Here, you mentioned the John Anderson race in 1980. That just jogged my memory. Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of where you are right now, New York City, saying, depending on how this all shapes out, meaning maybe if it's a Trump-Sanders general election, hey, maybe I get into the race, another billionaire in the race, and maybe I have a shot. Do you think that's a realistic possibility? What would that do to a race?
Well, you know, I think that there are a few things going on that you kind of went through. Number one, he probably only enters if both Trump and Sanders win the nomination. At this point, Trump winning the nomination doesn't seem so far-fetched. Sanders is still a little bit far-fetched, but let's say he does get that. Bloomberg has one thing going for him that pretty much no other candidate could, and that is, as a third party or an independent candidate, he will spend upwards of $1 billion, perhaps more so than that, on the campaign. That's a plus. The real problem for him, to be honest, is that the way he is positioned on the issues is not something that I think really appeals to most of America. He's socially liberal. Well, he's more economically conservative. If Trump has taught us anything, in fact, that's the opposite of what people like. They like someone who's a little more socially conservative while more economically liberal. Bloomberg also doesn't have much of a personality. I mean, Trump, you know, will be bombastic. Michael Bloomberg is a technocrat. It seems like a nice guy from everything. You know, I've met him in person, but in reality, there's not really a lot there. I would be very skeptical of that. But you know what? Throw $1 billion of ads on the air, who knows what might happen.
And Harry, Monday is kind of when the rubber meets the road, when we find out whether at least some of Donald Trump's poll numbers have been inflated or not. Do you have any predictions for what's going to happen on Monday?
Well, you know, a very interesting poll came out today from Monmouth University, which basically suggested that Donald Trump wins this caucus the higher the turnout is. And if you can get a higher turnout than we've ever had for a caucus, he probably wins. If, however, the turnout is the same as it was 4 years ago for the Republican caucus, it looks like a toss-up. So my guess, in all honesty, based, you know, the 538 sort of conventional wisdom, is probably that the idea that this is going to have a much higher turnout than normal is not going to come to fruition. But even if it's the same turnout than it was as it was 4 years ago, Trump still has a very good shot of winning this thing.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Dan on the line in Tripoli. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think Trump is smart to stay away from the debate. I don't think he has anything to prove. And I really think he'd be debating on a different level than the mainstream Republican candidates are. Trump has enunciated what he, in broad sweeps, what he wants to do. I think all he has to do is stand pat on that and let the voters make up their minds.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. So, yeah, that's the thing, the voters making up their minds there. Harry, do you agree with Dan? It's a smart move to just kind of let it ride at this point?
You know, if you're leading in the state, and most of the polls show you leading in the state, why should you give your opponents a chance to bring you down a peg or two? The news will be that he sat out the debate, not that he made some sort of boneheaded error or one of his opponents made him look foolish. Instead, it's going to be of him not being there, but he'll be on plenty of television anyway. I don't necessarily see this as a poor move. It could end up being so, but at this point, we're open as to whether or not this will be a bad move.
We're talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, looking at the latest in national politics, including tomorrow night's Republican debate, absent the Republican frontrunner, and the Iowa caucuses of both parties coming up on Monday.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of Donald Trump's decision not to attend the final debate before the caucuses? And what are your thoughts about the upcoming caucuses? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, looking at the latest in national politics and that upcoming Iowa caucus.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Who do you think will win the caucuses? And what do you make of Donald Trump's debate boycott? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Another caller now. Bob is with us in Oshkosh. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? Hey, you know what I think is that the Oregon standoff took place. Donald Trump's fundamental base is the extreme right wing. And basically he doesn't want to take a stand because he doesn't want to irritate his potential base. He doesn't know really, he's kind of caught. He doesn't know what to say. Thanks.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Harry, is Donald Trump's base the extreme right wing, as Bob says?
You know, this is a very interesting situation, and I guess extreme could be defined in many different ways. What we do know from the polls is the people who tend to support Trump, in fact, would not call themselves very conservative. They may be, a number of them may be members, or they would call themselves affiliated with the Tea Party. But rather, what they really are, they tend to be lower class white voters who are angry with what's going on. Now, I'm not sure whether or not that necessarily correlates well with the folks out in Oregon, but I will say that he does tend to do well among those who are very, very angry with the government, with the way things are going. But I'm not necessarily sure I would call them extremely conservative. Rather, I would just say that they are extreme in some of their positions, but perhaps not in others of them.
Where does that position Donald Trump with, quote-unquote, establishment Republicans then?
Well, this has been one of the most fascinating things of this campaign, at least over the last few weeks, is where, you know, Chuck Grassley went to one of Trump's campaign rallies. Terry Branstad, who's the governor of Iowa, basically said, don't vote for Ted Cruz, but didn't say anything about not voting for Donald Trump. That's partly because they really just hate Ted Cruz. I'm not sure if it's nearly as much of an embrace of Trump, but they really haven't gone out of their way to go after him. So, I mean, Trump is certainly not part of what I would think most of us would call the establishment, but he certainly doesn't seem to be as disliked by them as Ted Cruz is.
Now, let's talk about the establishment wing. Who do they have their chips on, if anybody at this point? Jeb Bush, a lot of money went his way. Some life in the polls in New Hampshire for him, I gather. Marco Rubio still not getting the traction people thought he would. Kasich? I don't know. Who are they looking at to emerge here?
What we would call the establishment lane, the whole thing is a mess. You know, in New Hampshire, you have Kasich, you have Christie, you have Bush, you have Rubio. They're all between, say, 7 or 8% and 15% of the vote. None of them are breaking out. And part of that may be because Rubio probably has the best chance of breaking out among them. But if you look at Rubio's record, he tends to be far more conservative than the average person in the Congress in D.C. His voting record tends to not align with party leadership as often. They probably want to see if someone like a Bush could break out in New Hampshire, and not just in one poll or two polls that includes an internal poll of his, but a more, you know, really a few reputable pollsters. So they're really split at this point. My guess is Rubio has the best chance of breaking out, but this election, best guesses haven't always gone the way that they should.
Let's leave the Republicans and Donald Trump for a moment. Talk about the Democratic side of things. Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, how are they positioned right now as we move forward? Are we in the middle of a Sanders surge?
Well, this is an interesting thing. I guess it depends how you define surge, over what time period. It's very clear looking at the polls in Iowa, pretty much anywhere, as a matter of fact. If you look between, say, the December 25th and then January 5th, there was something that happened, and Sanders went right up in the polls, climbed a number of percentage points. But over the last about 2 weeks, it seems like it has leveled out. You know, we have a forecast at 538, and basically Clinton has maintained a lead in the state of Iowa, enough of a lead that makes her the favorite, not enough of a lead that eliminates Bernie Sanders' chance of winning, but she has maintained a lead in the average of polls, and the polls that have tended to show Sanders surges are done by a methodology where they call up random people who they don't necessarily know if they're a registered voter or not. They ask him, but that technique hasn't tended to be the best in the past. The polls with the better techniques have continued to show a small but sustained Clinton lead in Iowa.
I saw a chart of support for those two, Sanders and Clinton, by age range. I don't remember if it was from you all at 538 or not. Young voters, boom, the 70-something-year-old guy, Bernie Sanders. They love him. And then it slants down from there, and Hillary Clinton is the exact opposite. Younger voters, not so sure. The older you get, the more they support her. What do you make of that?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing that's going on here. I think that there are a number of things that are happening. One, the younger voters on the Democratic side tend to be more liberal than the older voters. So obviously they're going to go with the more liberal candidate in Bernie Sanders. I think the other thing that's going on is younger voters tend to be more anti-establishment than older voters. So, of course, they're going to go with Bernie Sanders, who's a guy who you can say a lot of things about him, but certainly outsider is a word that rings right and true to me. But, you know, it has been a major split. You know, if you look at the 18 to 29-year-olds, Sanders leads by upwards 50 percentage points plus, depending on the poll. And then you might get the exact same split but opposite for Clinton among those 65 and older. But that's a split that I think Clinton's more than willing to go with going into an Iowa caucus where those older voters are more reliable, tend to be better spread out, which is good for the way that they count the delegates on caucus night. That probably might even give her a little bit more of an edge. It's a very technical thing that they're going through, but you'd much rather have support spread out throughout the regions of Iowa, while Sanders' support tends to be more located in college towns, and that may mean that the polls overestimate how many delegates he may actually get on caucus night.
We're talking national politics right now with Harry Enten from 538. And looking at Sanders, early on he was almost seen as this single-issue candidate. He wanted to talk income inequality, and all roads kind of led to Rome. How has that developed?
You know, to be honest, I mean, he certainly has, you know, spoken out more about foreign policy, but the focus of his campaign continues to be income inequality. That is the thing that I believe drives him. Again, he's trying to spread out. He's talking more about issues that affect non-white voters. But at the end of the day, it really is The corporations, you know, tend to be the things, and he likes to bring it back to that whenever he's debating, whenever he's talking about things. That's where he feels most comfortable.
Harry, this is going to be the last time we talk to you before the Iowa caucuses. You wrote a piece about how reliable polls are for something like the Iowa caucuses, for these smaller samples, these smaller states. There's more chaos. How much can we take the polls that are out there now and read them and feel like, yeah, on Wednesday, we know what's going to happen on Monday?
You know, I think what we can say is that we're pretty sure that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders will finish 1-2 on the Democratic side, or 2-1. Martin O'Malley really has no chance. Probably the same thing on the Republican side with Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. But the order of which they finish and whether or not Marco Rubio perhaps ends up as a strong third place versus a weak third place, those we're not so sure about. We can't be exactly sure who's going to be 1-2 and how strong Rubio's going to finish up, but we're fairly sure that it's going to be 1-2, either Cruz and Trump or Sanders and Clinton on the Democratic side and Rubio in third place on the Republican side.
So traditionally, looking at who comes out the victor after Monday from the Iowa caucus, how unstoppable does that person become?
It depends how well they're set up in New Hampshire, how well they're set up in later states. You know, John Kerry, for instance, in 2004 won the Iowa caucus and then was from next door to New Hampshire and Massachusetts and ramshot the entire field. But then, of course, last time Santorum won in Iowa, and then 4 years prior to that, Huckabee won in Iowa, and they weren't able to do anything in New Hampshire. They weren't able to go on and win the nomination. If Clinton wins in Iowa, her chances of winning the nomination are pretty much 100%. If Trump wins in Iowa, I think his chances of winning the nomination also go up significantly. But if Cruz were to win in Iowa, there's still some questions over whether or not he can win support in the Northeast in states that don't have a high evangelical base.
Let's bring on one more caller. Bring us full circle here. I think we've got Ray on the line in Stevens Point. Ray, hi.
Hi. Trump has assured himself that he will control all the media after the debate, because being not at the debate, after the debate, every media outlet is going to be open to Trump telling them, asking him questions about what he thought about every bit of criticism he may have received during the debate.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. And Harry, that's been a lot of the commentary now that he's baffled people, but Donald Trump ultimately has played the media like a secondhand fiddle.
That's exactly right. He is. His support is largely driven by the fact that he's able to concentrate media on him, and this move assures it. But, of course, we'll see. Maybe this time he's been too smart for himself. We'll find out on Monday.
Well, Harry, I remember we talked to you several months ago, and we talked about Donald Trump emerging, and you said, are you not entertained? Is it still entertaining? How are you feeling about this candidacy right now?
I mean, I still wake up and not sure what Donald Trump is going to do, but ask me again after Monday when if he's won that caucus, and we'll see if I'm still entertained by a man who has never held political office and doesn't really seem and has a somewhat of a policy platform, but certainly not as detailed as people were used to seeing winning Iowa caucuses or winning primary contests. But so far, I mean, it's still the strangest election season I've ever seen.
All right, we'll check in next week. Harry, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics and the run-up to the Iowa caucus.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Earlier this month, the Wisconsin State Assembly passed a bill that would effectively lift the state's ban on new nuclear power plants. The bill would remove clauses from the current state law that say a plant couldn't burden tax ratepayers and that there must be a federal facility for storing waste. Those two clauses have prevented new nuclear power plants from being built since no central federal repository exists, and that leaves nuclear plants to store their waste on site.
We're getting two different perspectives on this bill now. First, we'll hear from Michael Corradini. He's a professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison, and he's in support of this change. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we have that right. The word moratorium I don't think is in current law, but in effect, those two clauses we mentioned are a moratorium on new plant construction here in Wisconsin. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. There's two, as I understand the bill that was passed back in 83, there were two provisions. One, that it shows that nuclear power would be cheaper than other forms of energy. And two, that until there is a federal repository or movement towards that. So, yes.
Are those good reasons to not be looking at nuclear power plants? Is it a bad idea to build them if we can't keep it cheap, if we don't have that federal repository?
Well, I think two things. One is the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, that's their job to decide whether or not one particular method of producing electrical energy is cost competitive. And so having a bill such as this is just duplicative to what the Public Service Commission can do relative to that. In terms of the repository, the current administration stopped the licensing of the Yucca Mountain repository back in 2009 and created a parallel path where they are now looking at an interim storage of spent fuel somewhere in the country. A number of states are starting to apply for that, and simultaneously they're looking for a request by other states to site a repository. And in that case, three states have already expressed interest, that being Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. So both provisions of the moratorium, in my mind, are not really operative, and it should be removed.
Bigger picture, you mentioned that was passed in 1983. We're in 2016 now. Should we be looking to nuclear power, to new nuclear power plants, as part of our energy mix in Wisconsin and in the nation?
Well, in the nation now, there are five plants under construction. Actually, four. One has just received a license, and construction is completed at Watts Bar, and that will essentially load fuel and start operation this year. Four others are under construction, two in Georgia and two in South Carolina, of a new passive design. In Wisconsin, everything is very much location-oriented. In Wisconsin, we are not growing in electricity demand as quickly as the Southeast. So these new smaller modular reactors could be quite interesting and attractive for us. There are two companies in the United States, Babcock & Wilcox and NuScale, that are designing and essentially licensing these small modular reactors.
Talking to Michael Corradini from UW-Madison, where he's a professor of engineering physics, looking at nuclear power and Wisconsin, a possible change in state law that would make it possible at least to build new nuclear power plants here in Wisconsin. Well, Michael, back especially in the 80s, there were a lot of concerns about safety of nuclear power plants, the worry of a worst-case scenario, a meltdown, some kind of radioactive pollution. Is this something that you are particularly worried about in this day and age with a new nuclear power plant?
No, I am not. I think the public should be aware that there, with any sort of technology, there's a chance of some sort of accident that's going to be a concern to the general population. But in terms of the performance of plants in the United States, they've been extremely safe and reliable. So I have no concerns.
A lot of people think Three Mile Island as a potential hazard, as something that could have been a bigger problem than it was. Is that something that should be looming large in our minds?
Well, TMI was not was definitely an accident that should have been prevented. And from the standpoint of what it is now, there's been a number of measures taken by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry, and because of that, I think the chances of anything like TMI in the United States now is much lower, easily an order of magnitude lower.
Another common objection is that waste issue, as you mentioned, Yucca Mountain, where the federal government was trying to create a storage facility, didn't happen. It was a controversy for years and years. Doesn't look like any. You mentioned there's another process going along for a possible site. In the meantime, though, should we be building plants if we don't know what we're going to do with the spent nuclear fuel?
Well, currently, the spent nuclear fuel is stored on the sites of the various plant sites, and it's perfectly safe in that regard. I think from a common-sense standpoint, there has to be a centralized facility, and that's what's going forward with the current administration. And as I had said earlier, there's two paths that are being pursued simultaneously. One is to have a centralized storage facility, and one is to essentially get states to basically ask to have a repository sited in their state. The current administration's view was that the folks of Nevada never agreed to the site and therefore were not active and positive participants in the process, whereas those in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, which are interested, actually want to site a repository in a particular region of their states.
Would Wisconsin be a place that would be storing nuclear waste potentially on plant sites and beyond?
I doubt that seriously. That's not really. There was a study done back in the early 1980s, and some sites up north were considered. But the population density of Wisconsin, even up north, and the location close to water makes that essentially really not a feasible approach.
In recent years, one of the arguments for nuclear power has been, hey, it's a better alternative to coal, oil, natural gas when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. Is this something that could make a significant difference when it comes to climate change?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Nuclear power, would it help us deal with climate change as an alternative for creating electricity to fossil fuels?
Well, nuclear power is probably the most important way to deal with climate change as a reliable and baseload method of electrical energy production, in comparison to renewables, which are excellent, but they're intermittent. They only work when the sun shines or the wind blows.
And the cost, getting back to that issue, that's one of the parts of the law that could change. Is nuclear power cost competitive, especially in an era now of cheap natural gas, cheap oil, cheap coal, too?
Well, it depends if. So the answer to your question in that regard is if we want to continue to rely upon methods of energy which release CO2 to the atmosphere, then that they're potentially available. But I think nuclear power is quite reliable, safe, and essentially carbon neutral.
And you mentioned newer, smaller nuclear power plants. So what kind of options are out there these days?
Well, I had mentioned there are two types of plants that are being considered. One that is being built, which is essentially these passive advanced plants, light water reactors, the AP1000, which is a Westinghouse design, and the General Electric ESPWR, which is a GE design. But also I mentioned the other two companies, which are looking at small modular reactors, so not 1,000 megawatts, but essentially 10 times smaller in size, 100 megawatts, 200 megawatts, which could be sited in a number of places in Wisconsin, for example, and be quite reliable and safe.
supposing the law changes and the moratorium is gone, do you see nuclear power plants being built here in Wisconsin anytime soon?
Well, anytime soon, if you're going to say anytime soon is in the next year, no. In the next 10 years, I think it's quite possible.
And do you think that that public attitudes have changed? Again, back in the 70s and 80s, a strong anti-nuclear power sentiment. Do you think that public opinion has changed enough to allow that to happen in, as you say, the next 10, 15 years?
Oh, I think so. I think at least from the people that I speak to, now we're talking about the state, so my answer to your question is I think quite possibly. If we're talking nationwide, it's always been quite positive towards nuclear power. It's a matter of if it fits into the energy mix of the location.
And one last thought, the news from Japan a few years back, the Fukushima plant, a worst case there, earthquake plus tsunami. We've definitely had callers bring that up over the last year or so, saying that is the argument, that's the reason we shouldn't build nuclear power plants. What do you say to that?
I think that's not an issue, at least in the United States. What I'll call the circumstances of Fukushima would not be repeated in the United States, so I don't think that's a reason not to pursue nuclear power in the United States.
We'll leave it there. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Corradini. He's a professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison, with us to explain his support of a bill that would end Wisconsin's moratorium on new nuclear power plants.
We're talking about a bill that would end Wisconsin's nuclear power plant moratorium. The bill passed in the state assembly a couple of weeks ago, and it goes next to the Senate. We just heard from Michael Corradini, a professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison.
Now we have Al Geddix in the studio with us to explain why he's against this change. He's executive secretary of the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council and emeritus professor of sociology at UW-La Crosse. Al, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
So, in a nutshell, why do you think it's a bad idea to end the effective moratorium on new nuclear power plant construction here in the state?
Well, one has to look at the history of the nuclear power moratorium, which is, in fact, setting specific conditions, one of which, probably the most important, is that there can't be a new nuclear power plant unless we have a way to dispose of the nuclear waste. In the 1980s, Wisconsin was considered as a second a repository, assuming Yucca Mountain would go ahead, because there wasn't enough space in Yucca Mountain to take all the nuclear waste that needed to be disposed of. So the Wolf River Batholith in northeast Wisconsin was a major focus of the Department of Energy's search for a second nuclear waste repository. And during the 1980s, the people in that area, including four Indian tribes, massively opposed that project, and the Department of Energy left the state at the same time as the nuclear moratorium was enacted, after a 1983 referendum in which 89% of the people of the state of Wisconsin voted against Wisconsin becoming a nuclear waste repository. If you lift the restriction on no nuclear power plants without a waste disposal site, you are setting up the state of Wisconsin to become, if not the first, then certainly the second nuclear waste repository if other sites go ahead. If other sites don't go ahead, as in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, as Michael Corradini suggested, Wisconsin might become the first site. If you look at the latest information from Sandia National Laboratories, which is a Department of Energy subcontractor, they have looked specifically at granite formations, which is precisely the rocks that are being considered in northern Wisconsin. Those are considered the most stable geologic formations for the disposal of nuclear waste. We are essentially going into this blindfolded because we haven't had a discussion of whether this is what the citizens of Wisconsin want if they lift that nuclear power moratorium.
But as I understand it, we're seeing actual proposals from Texas and some other states actively trying to get this site. Why would anybody seek out a state like Wisconsin, which isn't pursuing that actively, when there are maybe some more hospitable alternatives for those sites?
The reason that Wisconsin has to be concerned, even if there are hospitable sites in those other states, is because, as with Yucca Mountain, there is not enough storage space in any one of those locations to fit all the spent nuclear fuel that is coming out of nuclear power plants. And so even under the best of circumstances, assuming that the populations in those areas are actually in favor of those projects as opposed to the governments, which is a major distinction people have to understand, there is still a necessity to look at a second repository, and Wisconsin is high on the, it was high on the list in the 1980s, and it is still high on the list now.
We're currently at nuclear power plants storing waste on site in many cases safely. As far as I could tell, no major incidents with that. Why isn't that an alternative until a new site is found?
Well, on-site storage is not a long-term solution. In an era of climate change where you have major disruptive weather events like heavy rainfall, storms, earthquakes, the stability of those dry cast storage at those nuclear power plants is a safety consideration. In 1993, it was a major flood in the Mississippi River, and right in the middle of the Mississippi River Delta, you had the XL power plant next to the Prairie Island Reservation. That island was flooded during that event, and the last thing you want to have happen with on-site storage is a major weather event that disrupts the stability of those dry casks and exposes the population to the possibility of radioactive contamination. In Fukushima, that is precisely what happened. You had a tsunami, major flood event that shut down the electrical generating capacity to cool the super hot and radioactive fuel rods in the plant, and that resulted in a triple meltdown of radioactive fuel. That is exactly what we want to avoid, and that is a long-term security and safety concern for any long-term on-site storage.
A bigger picture, the case for nuclear power in recent years has been we've got climate change happening. We've got these fossil fuels that bring a lot of kinds of pollution. They have a death toll in effect, from the coal mines to asthma sufferers and pollution. Nuclear power, not completely risk-free, not downside-free, but a better alternative when it comes to pollution and climate change than the fossil fuels we rely on now.
There's no question that nuclear is a better alternative than fossil fuels. The problem with nuclear power is that it is not carbon-free. There are all sorts of carbon emissions at every stage of the nuclear fuel cycle, from mining, milling, fuel enrichment, fuel fabrication, construction of nuclear power plants, decommissioning, nuclear waste disposal. If you add up all those emissions, what you have is nuclear giving off far more carbon emissions than the renewable energy alternatives that are safer and more easily constructed over a shorter period of time. Nuclear power is not a long-term, it is a long-term energy alternative. It requires a long lead time, 10 to 15 years, $10 to $15 billion per plant. No utility can afford that kind of expense, and people that are experiencing the effects of climate change now can't wait 10 years for a nuclear power plant to reduce carbon emissions when it's cheaper, safer, and more effective ways of reducing carbon are already available through wind, solar, and other renewable technologies.
One argument against that idea that we can rely on these renewables is that they're not a baseload kind of thing. They come when they want to come. When the sun's up, when the wind's blowing, we don't yet have the technology to cost-effectively, to efficiently use that electricity when we want it. Nuclear can do that. We run it as much as we need.
This is a myth of the nuclear industry promoting this so-called nuclear renaissance. Wind is not normally considered a baseload technology, but in fact it is. Dr. Arjun Makhijani from the Energy and Environmental Institute has a long-term plan for replacing all of the electricity in the United States with renewable resources, using wind power as a baseload technology. Even if the wind doesn't blow, we have the capability of storing that energy through the technology of compressed air batteries that make available that wind energy when the wind doesn't blow. Same thing with solar technology. If you combine that with geographic dispersion of these renewable resources, you have essentially a more reliable baseload technology than nuclear. Nuclear plants can't operate in times of drought. You have to have a constant cooling of those hot nuclear rods in the nuclear reactor. And during times of drought, which are going to be increasingly prevalent in periods of climate change, those plants have to be shut down because they cannot guarantee the safety of the plant when those conditions exist.
Talking to Al Geddix, he's with the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at UW-La Crosse, about the idea of ending Wisconsin's nuclear power plant construction moratorium that dates back to 1983. And Al, some people are saying This is a law from the 80s. It's based on arguments and technology from the 80s. Nuclear power plants can be smaller now, more efficient, and safer than they were. We should sit back and enjoy the benefits that modern nuclear power technology can bring us.
Those plants that they're constructing in Georgia and South Carolina are the latest advances in alternative and supposedly more safer nuclear technology. Those plants are years overdue. They are billions of dollars over budget. The plant at Vogtle, South Carolina, went from $14 billion to $19 billion. Those plants cannot be relied upon to provide the kind of security against global warming when there are safer, cheaper, and more reliable sources of energy available.
Al, briefly as we wrap up, if the law changes and it says that, hey, now nuclear plants can happen in Wisconsin, do you think they will happen in the near future?
Wall Street won't fund the nuclear industry. The insurance industry won't fund the safety of nuclear plants. There's no way that the nuclear industry can go ahead without massive public subsidies, billions of dollars, or through subsidization by ratepayers like the ones in South Carolina and Georgia, where ratepayers are essentially paying the utilities to construct nuclear power plants that won't come online for the next 10 years. This is a massive ripoff of taxpayers and consumers who right now are protected from that kind of exorbitant exploitation by the existing conditions for siting a nuclear plant, namely that ratepayers won't be overtaxed, mm-hmm. and there will be a nuclear waste repository available for the nuclear waste.
Al, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Al Geddix, Executive Secretary of the Wisconsin Resources Protection Council, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at UW-La Crosse. We've heard two perspectives on a possible change to Wisconsin's nuclear power moratorium. Today is a big anniversary for a Wisconsin TV icon. Laverne and Shirley hit the airwaves 40 years ago today.
The hit show was set in Milwaukee with the main characters working in the fictional Schott's Brewery. It was a spinoff from another Wisconsin-based show, Happy Days, and both shows were created in the 1970s and set in the 1950s and the 1960s.
Important clarification, Laverne and Shirley was set in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, but it was filmed in, where all the stuff was filmed, California. Until the last couple seasons, though, when it was set and filmed in California. Laverne and Shirley moved to California, and everybody followed them along for some reason. I guess they automated the Schott's plant or something like that.
And I would argue that that is when Laverne and Shirley jumped the shark.
Oh, well, obviously.
It has to be in Wisconsin.
And, you know, this we've talked before about how Wisconsin is represented in popular culture, and Laverne and Shirley, Happy Days at the center of that. It means something they were set here, I think.
Yeah, people from Wisconsin are nice. Maybe they're funny. I don't know. Do you identify with one of the characters the most? You've got Lenny, Squiggy, Laverne and Shirley.
Maybe just because I like Michael McKean, I guess I'd be the Lenny.
I'm going to go Laverne.
I could see that. I would choose Laverne. I'm probably Lenny.